All right, we're going to end the unit today, which means the test is exactly a week from now. This has been kind of a survey unit. We went over major groups of organisms, right? We had a chapter on prokaryotes, and then a chapter on protists mostly, which are some of the eukaryotes, and a eukaryote that isn't an animal, plant, or a fungus. Then we had a chapter on plants and fungi. And finally, we're going to have a chapter on animals to round out the eukaryotes. And we see a couple animals right here in the opening slide, one capturing another. And the reason this is a slide, an opening for this chapter, is that the appearance of animals really made the world quite different. It made it a much more dangerous place to live, because animals are really just portable eating machines, right? Highly portable eating machines. I talked about the fact that we're called animals because we're animated, right? We move around and we carry our digestive system with us so that we can carry our food with us. We don't have to stay there and eat whatever is there at that point. We can capture them and be on our way and capture even more. So it really has ecologically changed the face of the earth for animals to show up. Let's talk about when they did show up, by the way. Slide 2 is a tree of animals, just like plants, just like fungi. Animals is a true clade. It's a monophyletic taxon. So there's one tree with a common ancestor. Although this tree is dated incorrectly, I don't know whether the publisher knows about this or not, but this implies that animals started about 650 million years ago. That's actually goes back farther than that. Animals are about 770 million years old as a group. Now that is, as I was talking about in, I think it was last week, that's much longer than plants have been on Earth, right? Or on land, which is where they live. Why does that make sense? Even though animals depend on plants nowadays? Why does it make, how can it be that animals as a group is older than plants? Animals do depend on plants, certainly nowadays, but obviously there is a time when they didn't, because plants didn't exist yet, right? Well, plants started out on land from an algal ancestor from the ocean, right? And so there weren't any animals on land yet. That's what you shouldn't forget. We're used to thinking about land animals because we are land animals. But it wasn't until there was a lot of history of animals already in the ocean that there finally were animals on land. By then, plants were there already. All right. So even though that's really, forget about this error, that node that defines all of animals should be a little bit farther back in time, about 770 million years ago. But what we see in the tree as the endpoints of the tree here, these various lineages correspond to phyla. Now, phyla is just the plural of phylum. Animal is a kingdom, right? Within the domain Eukarya. And kingdoms are bigger than phyla. There are several phyla within a kingdom. Well, there are more phyla than are listed here. These are just some of the really important animal phyla, with some cartoon representatives shown next to them. One thing that you see on this is that sponges, as a group of animals, is different from all the others, phylogenetically speaking. In terms of what you know about phylogenetic trees, how would you describe sponges? Just based on where they are in the tree. Right. Sponges make up the basal group of animals. because their lineage goes all the way back to the ancestor, right? And so they are likely to be closest to the, you know, they're obviously sponges still exist. They are likely to be closest to what the original animals looked like. Not identical, of course, but they are the basal group, and they're different in other ways as well. All animals are multicellular. They're not necessarily big. Multicellular just means more than one cell. There are some really tiny animals. All are multicellular, though, including sponges. Sponges are different from the rest of the group, though, because, well, for a couple major reasons. Although they are multicellular, like all animals, sponges don't have true tissues. So we say that they do not have true complex multicellularity. They are multicellular and can have a lot of cells in them. They can be big, but those cells aren't arranged into true tissues, which are, you know, like in our body, we're made of four types of tissue: muscular tissue, nervous tissue, connective tissue, and epithelial tissue. You don't have true tissues in sponges. You have different kinds of cells, but they're not as highly organized. So that's one difference from the rest of the pack. That, along with being basal. Another, though, has to do with symmetry. Nearly all animals are symmetrical in one way or another. Sponges are not. Much like plants. In fact, there's probably a lot of people that you just randomly take people off the street, ask them what a sponge is. A lot of them would think it's a plant before an animal. They're only superficially like plants because they're kind of shaped like plants, but they're not photosynthetic. You know, they are truly animals. But they don't, you know, a tree as a representative plant doesn't have symmetry, right? It kind of has random branching. And that's true for the sponges as well. The rest of the animals, though, have some form of symmetry, like we do. We're symmetrical right to left, at least on the outside of our body. We are obviously animals. Which of these phyla do we belong in? Which one of these cartoons represents us? Any idea? Chordata, right, the chordates. So this hagfish is closest to us compared to anything else in that tree. And we're going to, in this overall chapter today, we're going to make our way toward humans, going to more and more specific taxons, right? Starting with kingdom, going, getting finer and finer detail until we're actually humans. But I should say that chordates as a phylum has groups within it. A major group within chordates that makes up most of the chordates, but not all of them, is vertebrates. And we are vertebrates. In fact, you just randomly ask people to name animals, almost all of those animals they'll name will be vertebrates. In fact, almost all of them will be mammals, which is just one kind of vertebrate. You know, they'll say dog. They might say bird. That's a fellow vertebrate. You know, the things that most people go to zoos to look at are vertebrates. But the vertebrates are a tiny minority of the animals that are alive. The vast majority of animals are invertebrates, which includes most of the phyla shown here. And the original animals, of course, were invertebrates, and we evolved from them. They started out in the ocean. Another thing I'll talk about, I'm not going to go through all these phyla and say interesting things about them, but arthropods I just want to mention, which are shown on the bottom here, because by far, as phyla are concerned, the arthropods are the most successful in terms of adaptive radiation, number of species. Arthropods are by far the most successful animal phylum. There are about 1.5 million identified animal species living right now. Well, the vast majority of those are arthropods. About 1.3 of those 1.5 million overall animals are arthropods. There's arthropods and then everything else in a little group lumped together. And the main reason that there's various reasons why arthropods, just as a group by themselves, are really successful. But there are many different kinds of arthropods. And one of those, if you think about the hierarchy of classification, you have domain, kingdom, phylum, and then what's next? What's the next major step after phylum? It's class. So there are several classes within each phylum. Arthropods is a phylum, and one, just one of the classes that are in arthropods is the class insects. And insects by themselves are most animals alive. 1.5 million overall animals, 1.25 million arthropods, of which 1 million are just 1 million for insects. And in fact, even if you only include beetles, which is just one type of insect, it's amazing how many different species of beetles there are, plus all the other insects. We'll talk a little bit later about why insects are so successful, but I wanted to mention that while we're looking at arthropods. Let's go on to three, though, and look at this basal taxon, which are the sponges. We can call them sponges, but the name of their group is Porifera, which is a good name for a sponge because it means full of holes, full of pores, full of openings. And we can see these pores here in this cartoon of a general body organization of a sponge. Now, there's tremendous variety of shapes and sizes of sponges. They don't all look like this one, but the organization is more or less the same, which means that there is a hollow interior where you have seawater, and then there are a bunch of holes or pores through the wall of the body of the sponge. And those are inlets through which water go into the central cavity that's common to, you know, a bunch of pores leading to one common cavity. And in that cavity, when you look at this cutaway view, notice that you have a bunch of these bluish-purple cells, and you see one in close-up, the upper right. These are called choanocytes, which are just one of the different kinds of cells in a sponge. Remember that true multicellularity means you have not only multiple cells, but multiple different kinds of cells. This is not complex multicellularity because there's not tissue, but there are different kinds of cells. Choanocytes, anyway, which are the choana part of that means collar, have these collar-like projections from the main cell body, and then a flagellum, a tail-like flagellum that moves back and forth. And when you have all of that flagellar motion happening all at once, it creates currents in the ocean, in the ocean water, that is what sweeps the water in through the pores and then out through a common opening somewhere on the main body. You see, leaving at the top. Well, it's not they don't do this for the purpose of moving water. They do this for the purpose of bringing the stuff that's living in the water, that's acting as the food for the sponge. Brings in microscopic organisms that then get stung and ingested by phagocytosis by the collar cells or choanocytes. Remember phagocytosis from Bio-181, it's a kind of vesicular transport, right? Inward vesicular transport. Phagocytosis is endocytosis of large chunks. And so that feeds the choanocyte, that provides the food directly for the choanocyte, but there's other kinds of cells making it up, right? These other cells need to have nourishment as well, and that's why not all of this taken in food gets used by the choanocyte. Some of it gets passed by what's called transcytosis, moving those vesicles to amoebocytes, which is a different kind of cell in the same organism, the same sponge. Amoebocytes are called that because they're continuously changing form, walking around, right? And those amoebocytes get fed by the choanocytes, but they then crawl around and deliver food to all the other cells in the sponge. Now, what did we say last week is the sister taxon to animals? Do you remember this? What is it? Well, we compared fungi and animals. They're really similar. If you go back even farther, yeah, they're grouped together like that. They're closer to each other than either is to plants. But when you get into the finer detail of the tree, I mentioned one group that is directly the sister taxon to animals. And those are called, does anyone remember? They're the ones that live unicellular lifestyles and look pretty much like one of these choanocytes of a sponge. The choanoflagellates. A choanoflagellate is living its own life as a single cell, but looks pretty much identical to one of these choanocytes. Well, this is part of the good evidence we have. It's not the only evidence. There's molecular evidence as well that tells us these two groups, animals and choanoflagellates, are sister taxa that evolved from the same ancestor. Slide 4. Before I talk about slide 4, let me quickly go back to the tree to show you that cnidarians is shown right below sponges. Now remember, you can swivel these nodes, so there's nothing about the positioning. But notice where cnidarians are in the tree. They're pretty primitive as well. Not as primitive as the sponges, but they're going way back in history. And they're not very complex animals compared to everything else. They're more complex than sponges, though. Cnidarians and related groups are not only animals, but they are animals with true tissues, unlike sponges. So let's talk about some cnidarians, or the kind of the body organization of cnidarians. Yes, they do have true tissues, but those tissues are not organized into organs like they are in more complex animals like us. So they're pretty much just tissues without true organs. And they have a pretty simple body. Most of them have a centralized hollow part that is called the gastrovascular cavity. And that gastrovascular cavity only has one opening. So it's an input and an output. So it serves as both mouth and anus, in other words. Food is taken in, digested and absorbed, and then residue is expelled from that same opening. And cnidarians also typically have stinging cells that paralyze their tiny prey that they eat, keeps them from escaping. But it includes some familiar animals like jellyfish and anemones and things like this. Jelly combs, those are all cnidarians. Now, unlike sponges, cnidarians have symmetry. I mean, this is another difference. One difference I already mentioned, they have true tissues. But they also have symmetry, like almost all animals. The type of symmetry that they have, though, is unlike our own symmetry. These are examples of animals with radial symmetry. Symmetry based on a central point rather than left-right or bilateral symmetry, which is what we have. And in fact, most animals have bilateral symmetry. Slide 5. These two things that we're looking at here are fossilized remains of ancient protists. So these aren't animals. These are protists that lived before animals on the left, and then after animals were on the scene on the right example. Now, don't think that these are the same size because they look the same size in the picture. One of these is blown up more. Look at the scale. This one is much bigger. The one on the right is much bigger than the one on the left. And also notice that it's not nearly as smooth. So this goes along with what I was telling you before, that animals coming onto the scene made life a lot more dangerous for everything, including other animals, but these aren't animals. So protists were smaller and less armored before animals. They became larger and more armored after the emergence of animals because that put a lot of selection pressure on them to defend themselves somehow. Okay, 6, in case you didn't get what my description of symmetry told you already, we can look at examples of the two major types of symmetry animals exhibit with some non-living examples as well. Radial symmetry is based on a centralized point. And if you draw a line through that point in any direction, you're going to have symmetry across that midpoint. Like on a pot, for instance. Well, that's the same as in an anemone or any other radially symmetrical animal, which include the cnidarians, like I said. The majority of animals, though, have symmetry like humans do, which is bilateral symmetry, meaning two-sided symmetry. That's not based on a central point, but a central line. And so bilateral symmetry is basically a left-right mirror image, at least superficially, right? We are not bilaterally symmetrical all the way through, right? I only have one liver and one spleen. It's on one side or the other. But our skin is superficially bilaterally symmetrical. That's one way of grouping animals together, by the way, because the symmetry is part of ancestry. And so keep that in mind. We'll be talking more about it when we look at a tree again in a second. Another way of grouping animals together, though, is on the basis of how many germ layers they have, if any. This is only in animals that that have true tissues and organs after those tissues. But this worm is a good example of what I'm talking about. These are called germ layers, which are two or three layers, two membranous layers that throughout development develop into various organs of the body. And so one way of grouping animals that have germ layers, which sponges don't and cnidarians don't, but most animals that you can think of do, this is one way to distinguish them, whether they have two germ layers or three. What were you going to say? The organs of the body. So they're germ layers because they occur early on in development, during germination or development, and then they they eventually develop into the various organs. Well, the simpler of the two possibilities is to just have two germ layers, which are called endoderm, in yellow here, and ectoderm, the bluish one on the outside. Some animals will have just two germ layers, ectoderm and endoderm, meaning outward. Derm means skin. That just means covering, though, not skin as you're thinking of it as an organ. So outer covering and inner covering, inner lining. Animals that have only those two germ layers are called diploblasts. Di means two. On the other hand, there are other animals that actually develop from three germ layers. So if they have three germ layers, as you might expect, they're called triploblasts. And that's what we're looking at here. This worm is an example of a triploblast. When they have three, they also have the same two that a diploblast has, ectoderm and endoderm, but then they have an intermediate one as well called mesoderm. Meso means intermediate. And so we're examples of triploblasts. Most familiar animals that you think of are triploblasts as well. So, as you might guess, ectoderm develops into external structures like the skin. Endoderm develops into deep structures like the digestive tract. And mesoderm develops into things that are between those extremes, other organs. Now, so that is one way of grouping, distinguishing groups of organisms on whether they are diploblasts or triploblasts. There's another thing that's shown by this slide, though. Notice that there is a body cavity in this example. Not all animals have such a body cavity. But that body cavity can also be called the coelom, C-O-E-L-O-M. And therefore, animals that have that coelom are called coelomates. And then animals that don't are called acoelomates, which means not having a coelom. So that's another way of distinguishing them. Now, what is the big deal about a coelom or a body cavity? Well, remember that animals' claim to fame and their reason that they're named that is their high movability, right? They not only by moving, I don't only mean locomotion, which means getting from here to there. Movement also means you're just moving your body parts with respect to the other body parts, even though you're not locomoting, right? Doing that is much easier for coelomates, because that body cavity allows for different layers of the body to move with respect to the other layers without rubbing the hell out of them, which would injure them. You know, a perfect example of this is serous membranes in the human body. You have different serous membranes. You have serous membranes around your lungs, for instance, and also one around your heart, plus others in the gut, in the abdomen. But anyway, let's think about the one around the heart. It's called the pericardium. It's a double-walled membrane. So there are two layers to it, and then between that is just a space with pericardial fluid. It's just liquid in between the two membranes. And that's really important, because every time your heart beats, if it didn't have that protective covering, it would be rubbing against your lungs, and both of them would be damaged in the process. Instead, it's covered by two layers with liquid in between them. If you can imagine a water balloon, that's not hard, I'm sure you can imagine a water balloon, but imagine a water balloon, especially one that doesn't have very much water in it, so it's easy to deform. And if you punch your fist into it, your fist representing your heart, the water balloon will kind of surround your fist. And so there will be a layer of latex directly around your heart or your fist, and then there will be water layer, and then there will be the other layer of the balloon also around, but not in direct contact, right? And you could move your fist around, and you wouldn't, you would easily be able to do that because of the water. It wouldn't rub on the stuff outside. And so that's what the body cavity is a big deal about. In animals, it allows their bodies to be highly movable without damaging themselves. And the more movable they became to be evolutionarily, the more successful they came at being portable eating machines. Okay, well, on slide 8, we see the overall animal tree again. This time we have a little bit more details. There's a few more phyla added. This still isn't all the animal phyla, but it's the main ones. Some of these we've already talked about. Remember, we are here at Chordata. But anyway, this one is dated better. The 770 million years ago, like I said, is when we recognized the beginning of animals from their protist ancestors. The new information here, other than just names of other phyla, are these names that we see in the gray boxes. Now notice that the entire tree is called metazoa. Zoo means animal, which is why zoos are called that, and which is why the study of animals is zoology. Anyway, metazoa is another name for all animals. And therefore sponges, as the basal group, are within that. Sponges are animals. Sponges are metazoans. But notice that they are not members of what we call eumetazoa, which is kind of a misnomer because eu means true or good. So eumetazoa kind of means true animals. Well, sponges truly are animals. But what eumetazoa is really referring to are the animals, only the animals, that have true tissues, which sponges don't. Okay? And so notice that that includes cnidaria, like we were just looking at. Tenophora is another related animal. They're kind of related to cnidarians, and they also have radial symmetry, like cnidarians do, unlike sponges, which don't have any symmetry. But notice this next gray box, Bilateria, which includes most animals. Includes most of the phyla. Well, Bilateria, why is it named that? What does that word refer to? Yeah, they are all the bilaterally symmetrical animals, which is most animals, including us. We're here in Chordata. Well, the other animals that have symmetry, which is not the sponges, so, in other words, the cnidarians and the tenophorans, notice that they are not members of Bilateria. They have radial symmetry. Okay? Most have bilateral, though. And then I just want to talk about one more of these gray boxes. This next one is Deuterostomia. Stome means mouth. Can also mean opening, but mouth specifically. Deutero means later. I'll explain why this makes sense. There are, among the animals that are in Bilateria, we're only talking about bilaterally symmetrical animals, not sponges, not cnidarians, not tenophorans. So the things that are bilaterally symmetrical, they are either protostomes or deuterostomes. Protostome literally means mouth first. Deuterostome means mouth second. Well, all of these bilaterians have two openings, unlike cnidarians with their gastrovascular cavity, which is just one opening, in and out through the same opening. Bilaterians have a mouth and an anus and a tube that leads from one to the other, a complete digestive tract, one way travel of stuff through it, just like in us. Well, that can develop in two ways. In some animals, before the tube forms, the first opening to form is the anus, and then the tube develops, and then the other opening, the mouth, develops later. Those are the deuterostomes. That includes us, notice. So we are mouth second or anus first organisms, animals. The other bilaterians are the protostomes. So Lophotrochozoans and Ecdysozoans together make up the protostomes. They develop in such a way that their first opening to develop becomes their mouth, and then the anus develops later. Notice that, by the way, that includes most animals, because that includes arthropods, which is most animals just by itself. Okay, now we can start working our way toward humans. What we see here is a fossil, picture of a fossil of our ancestor, not only because we're animals, but more specifically because we are chordates, right? Chordata is the phylum of animals that we belong to. That's a tiny, tiny minority of animals, remember, because most animals are invertebrates. Vertebrates as a group are just some, most, but only just some of the chordates. Anyway, here we're looking at an ancestral chordate. And you can, it kind of looks like a fish, as you see, which are fish are fellow vertebrates and fellow chordates. But this is really early in chordate history. If you look at the picture, though, this real fossilized photograph, it looks very similar to things, some chordates that are still around. A cartoon version is shown here in 10, just to show you the general body organization of a chordate. Now, there's all kinds of variation on this theme, so not all the bodies of chordates are shaped like this, but no matter how they're shaped, all chordates have these important features. They all have a notochord, this middle brownish one, or I don't know what color this is, yellowish brown. Notice it's labeled the notochord. That's why things that have this are called chordates, from the notochord word. A notochord is a slightly stiff, slightly flexible rod, more or less. Now, it's important for it to be somewhat stiff, because that is a structure that muscles can connect to. And there, you know, muscles are worthless. Since muscles can only pull, they can't really do any good unless they're pulling on something. Just like our skeletal muscles are connected to our bones, right? And we therefore, by contracting our muscles, pull our bones into different positions, changing our body positions. So the notochord is a major site for attachment of muscles in these chordates. But it's also important for it to be flexible. So it needs to be somewhat rigid and somewhat flexible. Why does it need to be flexible? Because when you have a bunch of muscles pulling on one side, it's going to bend it one way, and then muscles pulling it the other way are going to bend it the other way. That means the notochord can undulate, and therefore the body is going to push on the water and swim. Makes them very highly mobile. That's why chordates have been so successful. Above that in the picture, in yellow, is another feature of all chordates, which is the dorsal hollow nerve cord. Now, it develops along the notochord, but it becomes different stuff compared to what the notochord becomes if it develops into other structures, like it does in us. So in us, for instance, what does the notochord eventually develop into? The spine, or the spinal column. Bony structure, right? Hard stuff, but still flexible. The dorsal hollow nerve cord, on the other hand, develops into what? In us. Yeah, the central nervous system, including the spinal cord and the brain, develop from this nerve cord. Okay, so those are two major things that all chordates have. They also all have what is called a post-anal tail, meaning a tail that extends beyond the anus, after the anus, farther back. Now, we don't have a tail in our adulthood, but we start out with a tail. All chordates have all four of these major traits at least at some point in their development. They might not have it all the way through their life. But if you look at a picture of yourself when you were an embryo, you'd see that tail. And the other thing is pharyngeal slits. The pharynx is the throat, and the pharyngeal slits are what eventually in fish became gills. They're places for exchange of gas, respiratory gases, oxygen and carbon dioxide. Okay. Well, in the real photographs, as opposed to the cartoon, slide 11 shows you a lanceolate. This is a chordate. It looks today pretty much the same as that fossil did two slides ago. So some of these chordates really haven't changed much at all over hundreds of millions of years, and I shouldn't say hundreds of millions of years, millions of years. And still not only have these chordate features, but they have them through their whole life. They just look like that cartoon did. Others, on the other hand, only have those four characteristics at least some part of their life. Tunicates, for instance, are chordates. They change shape as they develop. These are things that you might have seen. They're called sea squirts. They're what they're sometimes familiarly called. They have an in-current siphon and an ex-current siphon. They suck water in one and then they squirt it out the other by contracting their body. And if the water level falls with the tide, for instance, so that they're right at the surface, you'll actually see them. It'll be like a spout of water coming out of them. Now, these are fellow chordates, so they're related to us by virtue of being chordates. But I said a little bit ago that chordates includes vertebrates. We are vertebrates, of course. The lancelet and the tunicates are not vertebrates. They are examples of chordates that are not vertebrates. The vast majority of chordates are vertebrates, but vertebrates is a smaller group within chordates. Does that make sense? Okay, so we're getting a little closer to humans now. Let's look at this tree on slide 12. Now, this is not the entire animal tree. Here we're looking at the vertebrate tree. So this ancestral vertebrate, that is just one of the lineages within chordates. Okay, we're getting more specific now. You understand what I'm saying there? Okay. Vertebrates obviously are named for the vertebral column. That's the big deal, the defining trait for vertebrates. And this first occurred in ocean-dwelling chordates. They became the first fish. So we are really fish when you get down to it, phylogenetically speaking. Well, that defines all vertebrates. Look at the gray boxes on the edge. All vertebrates make up this whole group. But then there are two major kinds of vertebrates, which are based on whether or not there is a jaw. So all vertebrates have a vertebral column. Some of them, but only some of those vertebrates, have a jaw. Those are more advanced vertebrates. The primitive vertebrates, or the basal vertebrates, had a mouth like all chordates do, but they didn't have a jaw with a hinge. So, the word that means jaw is gnath. And therefore, the primitive vertebrates, the ones without the jaws, get an A in front, meaning no, or not. Agnathans are jawless fishes. And they're still around. There's still examples of them around, like hagfish, which is what's shown above Mix and I, and lampreys. Here's a lamprey under Petromyzontida. They have a mouth, basically a circular mouth, that they use to suck on the surface of whatever they're eating. Just suction keeps them connected. They don't chew because they don't have a jaw. But they're successful in basically eroding the tissue away and getting blood to enter their mouth. The more successful group of vertebrates, though, which evolved later, are the ones that actually have a true jaw. And those are called the gnathostomes. Okay? Same gnath, meaning jaw, and stome, I said, means mouth, right? So jawed mouth. The jawed-mouthed fishes are the gnathostomes. And that, of course, includes us. So we are animals. More specifically than that, we are eumetazoans. More specifically than that, we are chordates. More specifically than that, we are vertebrates. More specifically than that, we are gnathostomes. So now, if you consider just gnathostomes, if you looked at just the gnathostome tree, it's defined by this one, this node, right? You can then subdivide gnathostomes into two major kinds of fishes, two major kinds of jawed fishes. And that distinction is based on the skeleton. Some gnathostomes, some jawed fishes, in other words, have a skeleton made out of cartilage. Tough, but not as tough as it could be. Those are called chondrichthyans, or the group is called chondrichthyes. Ichthy means fish. Chondro means cartilage. So chondrichthyes literally means the cartilaginous fishes. Okay, that's more specific than gnathostomes. All of these jawed fishes are gnathostomes, but the ones that have cartilage as their skeleton, and I mean cartilage for their entire life, because our own skeleton actually starts out as cartilage, but then it ossifies into bone. That's not what happens in a chondrichthyan fish. It stays as cartilage. So this includes, for familiar examples, this includes sharks, rays, and skates. Those all have cartilaginous skeletons, and so they are chondrichthyans. The other type of gnathostomes, though, have bony skeletons, truly mineralized hard bones like we do, and so they are called the bony fishes, or osteichthyans. Osteo means bone, ichthyans means fish, as I said before. So more specifically than gnathostomes, we are bony fishes, osteichthyans. Okay, that's this one. Now, if you consider just that tree, you can subdivide that again. And this distinction, when you subdivide the osteichthyans, or bony fishes, it's on the basis of what kind of fins they have. The bony fishes have fins, but some bony fishes have real sharp fins that don't have very much flesh on them. And some bony fishes have fins that are not all that sharp. They're more like lobes of meat or flesh. Well, the actinopterygii, which is this half of osteichthyans, are also called the ray-finned fishes. Actino means ray. The P-T-E-R What did I say that meant? Did I give you this word before? Probably thinking of a different class. P-T-E-R means wing. So the wings of fishes are the fins, but it means wing. And for instance, for aircraft, right? There are fixed wing aircraft, a regular plane, but there are also aircraft in which the wings move, and they move in a helical or corkscrew pattern, which is why those are called helicopters, or helicopter means helically moving wing. Well, actinopterygii means ray finned, and these are the ones that have these sharp fins, like fish that are typically caught when if you go fishing. There's not, you know, you when they fan those fins out, you see the bones making up the sharp spines, but there's not a bunch of muscle in there making them fleshy. The other kind of osteichthyans, though, are the so-called lobe-finned fishes, which are also called, another word for that is the sarcopterygians, or the group is sarcopterygii. It still has that tear in it, meaning wing, referring to fins. Sarco means flesh. In fact, your own muscles, which is your flesh, are made up of things called sarcomeres, same root. Okay, so that's us. We are not the ray-finned fishes. We are members of the lobe-finned, or sarcopterygians. Then, as you would guess, as now that you've gotten the pattern, we can subdivide lobe fins. And one of those divisions, which is the one that includes us, is the tetrapods. Now, what does that word mean literally? Four is tetra. What about pod? Feet. It means 4 feet. Really 4 limbs. They're not technically feet until you get later on, but all the tetrapods have 4 limbs. All right. Now, remember, everything we've talked about so far has been in the ocean still. The tetrapods, they're named after the fact that they have 4 limbs, and specifically limbs with digits, so fingers and toes. This includes, though, fish living in the ocean still. And remember, these are evolving from lobe fins. These lobe fins are the fish that have these meaty, kind of club-like fins rather than the sharp ones. Well, since they're so muscular or meaty, these fins can be used as for walking around on the bottom of the seafloor, or on the seafloor, the bottom of the ocean. All right, that's what the lobe fins can do. And in shallow places near the shore, they actually can get to the point where they are out of water. So now we're getting to the point where we're going from marine life finally to terrestrial life, which, of course, is what we live, right? That happened in lobe-finned ancestors, and it led to what we call the tetrapods. Tetrapods include a lot of the land-dwelling animals, not all of them. For instance, you already know that there's plenty of insects on land, right? Well, they're in a totally different group. They're not chordates, right? They're in they're arthropods. They have their own history, but they live on land with us. So, invasion of land from the water occurred multiple different times by different groups of animals, whereas invasion of land by plants happened only once. It's all from the same ancestor. All plants are related by the same ancestor, and they all dwell on land. Okay, now the tetrapods include, as you see here, amphibians, reptiles, and mammals, which I'm sure you've heard of these groups, but what seems to be missing from those? What four-limbed animals don't seem to be listed in amphibians, reptiles, and mammals? Familiar animals that live on land here with us. If I were to ask a kindergartner, don't overthink this. What major kind of animal, which has four limbs, is missing from this list, or seemingly missing? Birds, exactly. Yes. Birds is right. Well, it's not actually a mistake. Sometimes we say tetrapods are, I mean, just outside of biology, just common street language, we sometimes say that tetrapods are amphibians, reptiles, birds, and mammals. The reason it's not listed here, though, is because of something I told you in a different chapter. Phylogenetically speaking, birds are reptiles. They're just some of the reptiles, right? So by saying tetrapods includes amphibians, reptiles, and mammals, that means it also includes birds in there with reptiles. Okay? So now we're getting to something more familiar to us. We obviously are mammals, so we're members of this tetrapods. That's where this tree ends, but we're going to continue until we get all the way to humans. Just keep in mind, though, that tetrapods includes amphibians, reptiles, and mammals, because I'll have more to say about that. First, though, let's just take a little bit of a divergence along this going toward humans and look at slide 13, which is the fossilized remains of a jawed fish. Obviously, this is not an agnathan. This is a nathostome, right? A jawed fish. This is to show you just how big a deal this was successful-wise in terms of evolution. When the jaw came along as an innovation, that changed everything. This is what really made them eating machines. And it's just a pure coincidence based on how far this projector is from the wall. But this happens to be just about life size. Because notice that's a half a meter. Well, as it's projected right now, that is about a half a meter. So this is a pretty formidable foe if you're something that it can eat. And it can eat a lot of things. You can get a lot of things in that jaw. But it's a huge advancement in the success of their lifestyle. And that's, we have the same ancestor because we are fellow nathostomes. In slide 14, we see what I mentioned just a moment ago, that for animals, there were multiple invasions of land from the ocean, including our own lineage that came from the tetrapods, or that came from the lobe-finned fishes. But there are arthropods and crustaceans also. Crustaceans are arthropods. Anyway, they're a totally different group that invaded land as well. And plants, on the other hand, did it only once. And the reason for this is simply because it was harder for plants to do. They had, they evolved from an algal ancestor, right? Green algae that lived in the ocean. Well, to live on land, like I was talking about a little bit in that chapter, requires a lot of different hurdles to be overcome, right? If you're going to live. Like, you have to have a body that supports your weight because you're no longer in water, you're in air, and you'll collapse if you don't have a support structure inside you, a skeleton, in other words. Plants didn't have that, right? But animals already did. An exoskeleton in the case of insects, an endoskeleton in the case of the fishes that we evolved from. already there, so that wasn't a problem. All these rows in this table really refer to different problems that terrestrial life poses. And the point is that animal groups that were successful in invading already had a bunch of these problems solved in their lifestyle in the ocean already. Whereas plants had to, all the red ones are things that they had to evolve into place before they could be successful. And that's why it happened only one time for plants, multiple times for animals. For some insects, basically, they all they really had to do was evolutionarily change their respiratory system a little bit. They could almost literally just walk onto land. And ironically, the ocean is really the only major place on Earth where you don't have a lot of insects. There are some, but everywhere else in the biosphere you have insects because there's so many of them. Well, insects by themselves are successful, but that's the main reason why arthropods, which is the bigger group that includes insects, was so successful. And we're looking in slide 15 at the main kind of generalized body organization of an arthropod. There's tremendous variety in how their body is shaped, of course, but what they have in common is that they have a hard exoskeleton, usually made out of chitin, which is a type of structural polysaccharide. Like cellulose is for plants, chitin is a structural polysaccharide that animals make, and it's tough stuff as it needs to be the bony external armor. They don't have an endoskeleton like we do. They have an exoskeleton and then a soft interior. But another part of the body organization, though, is that they have segments that move independently of each other. And they differ greatly from species to species, different kinds of arthropods, in how many body segments they have. Many of the segments can feature legs. So that's another way that arthropods are different from each other. How many actual legs do they have? Well, there's a hell of a lot of variety. Some have a very many legs, some don't have all that many. But that's how you can tell you're looking specifically at an insect. All insects have 6 legs as opposed to other numbers for other arthropods. Like spiders have 8, right? Arachnids have 8. Those are also arthropods. All insects have 6, which is why another name for insects is hexapods. 6 legs. They also don't have things in place that make them excellent swimmers, like these appendages at the back that, when they're flipped, push well on the water. And notice that also not all of these legs are just for walking. They can be adapted for other purposes as well, like capturing prey. Well, I said a little bit ago that there are a million insects living. Those are just the ones that we have found. There's more than that living now. We just haven't found all the insects. But a million is, you know, that's 2/3 of all the animals known. That's just insects. And there's a huge variety of insects, as you know. Mostly they are grouped together based on things about their wings, which is why the various kinds of insects have that tear in them somewhere. Like butterflies and moths are lepidopterans, hymenopterans are the bees and wasps, and so on. So they're all winged, even though not all of them fly. But we can see a flying one in slide 17. This flying insect is obviously using its wings to fly. And that is not something that only insects can do. There are other winged creatures that fly, right? Mammals can do this. Those are the bats. And obviously birds can do this pretty well. They're famous for having wings for flight. But part of the huge success of insects is something about the way they fly that's different from how bats and birds fly. Bats and birds are both tetrapods, right? Remember, tetrapods are amphibians, mammals, and reptiles. And birds are reptiles. So, they all have four limbs. But think of a bird. How does it fly? The only way it's able to fly is that it has had to given up other use of its two of its limbs, half of its limbs, just for flight. And so now it can only walk with two, right? Same with a bat. It's given up two of its four limbs for the purpose of flight. Now that has great advantages, but those two examples are surrendering other use of those limbs. That's not what happened with insects, though. Insect wings are not derived from limbs. They're totally new structures. So they're able to keep all six of their legs for doing what those legs do otherwise, and then add two more appendages just for flight. And that was a hell of an advantage. Flight itself is an advantage, obviously, but if you don't have to sacrifice anything in the process, you're even better off. So that's part of why they have been so successful. Now let's get back to the story of working our way toward humans. This is slide 18. And what we're looking at here is a fossil that was a really important fossil find of a genus called Tictaalic. You don't have to remember that name, but anyway. Since then we've found others very similar to it. It was a huge find, though, because it was kind of an intermediate form between the ancestors of us that came from the ocean and the land-dwelling things that are like us now. Notice in the two boxes that this thing has certain fish characteristics and also certain tetrapod characteristics. So this is, you know, in the tetrapod lineage, and tetrapods includes us. It, unlike most fish, it has eyes on the top of the head rather than pointing to the two sides. And it, unlike fish, it has a movable neck. You know, fish can't do that, but we tetrapods can. But like fish, it has scales and fins and gills. So this basically is a fossilized finding of that transition period when the lobe fins invaded land to become the tetrapods. It is, in other words, a missing link. People who don't believe in evolution often say, where are these missing links, the things in between extremes? Well, this is an example of it. Tictaalic is what I was talking about before. That's this one. Notice that it's extinct. Its group is extinct, and most of these are extinct. They don't make their way all the way to the edge. But we still have amniotes, which is what we're in. We're getting there next, and amphibians, and we also have lungfishes still. Those are quite different from the tetrapods that are down here. But these are all tetrapods, by the way. They're different from the amphibians and the amniotes. But that's if you're only looking at extant or still living organisms. If you go back into the fossil record and when you finally find those fossils, you can see a gradual evolution of these forms. Okay, so now we... Slide 20. Now we are going to get more specific beyond tetrapods. Well, we've already gotten more specific because I told you that tetrapods includes amphibians, reptiles, and mammals, right? Amphibians is one of those groups. But even though we're working our way toward humans, amphibians is not the group that includes us. So it's just one type of tetrapod. We are not that type, though. These are all amphibians. And why are they called amphibians? I did talk about this word, I think, didn't I? The bi part of amphibian, as in biology, means life. Amphi means dual, right? Remember, I think we talked about amphipathic molecules, right? Having a dual preference. Yeah, well, amphibian means having a dual lifestyle. They live partly in water for part of their life and partly on land. So these are just major kinds of amphibians. You have salamanders, which you're probably familiar with. Toads and frogs, those are things you're familiar with. You might not have come across many Sicilians in your life. They are also amphibians. There's a good reason you probably haven't come across them, and that's because they live entirely underground their whole life, which is why they have evolved away their eyes. Eyes do no good if you're living in total darkness, and beyond doing no good, they actually do potential harm because they're sites for that invading bacteria can infect, right? So it's better to evolve them away. Just notice, though, that's their ancestors had eyes already, and then they lost that. Kind of like the limbs were lost in that lizard we were talking about before, right? That looked like a snake. So those are the amphibians, which is kind of one subdivision of tetrapods. The other, the rest of the tetrapods, which includes both the reptiles and the mammals, and remember that includes birds as well, those are all related in a way that amphibians are not. And that's because they are all amniotes. So the subdivision of tetrapods that we belong to is amniotes. Amniotes includes reptiles and therefore birds and mammals. Well, we're looking at an amniote egg in slide 21. And the main point of the slide is that all amniotes feature four extra embryonic membranes as part of their development. So not all amniotes have hard-shelled eggs. Some still do. Birds do and some reptiles do. We humans don't. But some mammals actually do even. Anyway, we all have eggs, whether they're hard-shelled or not. By the way, the hard-shelled egg of birds can also be called a cladoic egg. Anyway, that's not part of the extra embryonic membranes. I'm just talking about eggs for a minute. The extra embryonic membranes are called that because extra embryonic means outside of the embryo. The embryo is in the egg developing, but the membranes that I'm going to give you, these four, are outside of that. Still in the egg, but outside of the embryo, and therefore extra embryonic. Well, their names are amnion, allantois, chorion, and yolk sac. All right, those are the four extraembryonic membranes. So we, as amniotes, have those as part of our development. I'll just quickly go over what they do. The amnion, which is the blue one right here in this cartoon, is a sac directly around the embryo, and then there's fluid inside it. So it cushions the embryo. It's protection, shock absorption. The allantois, which is this darker orange one, which is highly vascularized, it more or less operates as a waste dump, especially for animals like birds, for instance, that are locked in this hard shell. You know, that embryo is alive and developing, and it is therefore creating waste as it develops. It needs to get rid of that waste, or at least to sequester it away from its body so it doesn't get toxic. And that's what the allantois can do. The chorion, which is this pinkish layer, is a membrane that assists in exchange of respiratory gases, oxygen and carbon dioxide. So it helps it respire. And then the yolk sac, obviously, is a sac filled of yolk, right? Yolk is mostly lipid. And why does it make sense that it's filled with lipid? What's special about lipid compared to carbohydrates or proteins? Yes, they are. Lipids have a much higher energy density, more than twice as high, meaning that a gram of lipid contains more than twice as much energy as a gram of protein or a gram of carbohydrate. So this is the food store. This thing is locked in the egg. It's living, it's developing, it's going to require energy to remain alive, but it's not eating, so it has to get its nutrients from a food store called the yolk sac. All right, so that's true for all amniotes, not the amphibians, though. The amphibians are not amniotes, only the reptiles and the mammals. So now we can continue and get closer to humans. We are more specific than tetrapods. We are amniotes. And now we're looking at... Oh, I'm sorry. We're taking another turn before we get back to humans. This is the reptiles. So we're within amniotes here. The amniote tree would be even bigger. Reptiles would be one division of amniotes, and the other division would be mammals, which of course includes us. But here we're looking at just the reptiles. And you can see here what I said a little bit ago. Birds are in here. Phylogenetically speaking, birds are reptiles. And even more specific, birds are dinosaurs. They just are the only dinosaurs that survived. All the other dinosaurs went extinct at Cretaceous extinction that I was talking about, where the meteor hit or the asteroid, whatever it was. Okay, what's something that is weird about this tree is turtles, which are also called chelonia. You don't have to remember that. Turtles are kind of perplexing. We just aren't able to figure out where the hell they fit in phylogenetically, which is why their lineage is drawn as a dotted line. We know they're reptiles, but they're so strange in a lot of ways that we don't really know where they fit in, who they're related to. So it's drawn in there. That's almost certainly not the truth. Notice that drawn in this way, it's a polytomy, which we know polytomies are not the truth, right? So we'll eventually figure out where turtles fit in, but anyway, birds are in there with dinosaurs. And these are closer, these reptiles in general are closer relatives than amphibians, where all three of us are fellow tetrapods, right? But we mammals are more related to reptiles than to amphibians, because reptiles and mammals are fellow amniotes, even more specifically than tetrapods. So now we can go to mammals, finally, in 23. And I don't remember whether I mentioned this before in a slide in a different chapter, but there are three major groups of mammals. First off, we just talk about the overall group called mammals. We're named for mammy, which is the plural of mamma. A mammary gland occurs in the organ called a mamma or a breast. And so that's why we're called mammals. All mammal species produce milk. Milk, you know, there's other things that look like milk and that sometimes have the name milk in other animals, like crop milk is whitish stuff that birds produce in their crop. But it is not milk at all. It just looks milky. True milk is made only by mammals. We also are the only animals that have true hair. So mammals produce milk and they have hair. But that's the overall group. There are three major kinds of mammals, as we see here. And we talked about, I at least gave you the names of these before. They are monotremes, marsupials, and eutherians. And monotremes, of these three, are the basal group of mammals. They're the most primitive, the ones that are most like the original mammal, the ancestor to all mammals. These are the ones that, from our point of view, are the strangest in their lifestyle. It's all relative, of course. They don't think they're strange. They think we're strange. But they're mammals, so they do produce milk. Unlike the other two groups, though, the monotremes do not have nipples. So they have milk-producing glands over a big chunk of their body, And it does that milk doesn't come out through nipples. It just oozes out of the skin, kind of like sweat, all over. And then the young just lap it up off of the skin, wherever it comes out. Another thing that's strange from our point of view is that monotremes lay hard-shelled eggs. By the way, these are the least successful in terms of adaptive radiation. There's only a few species of monotremes that still exist, including a couple echidnas. You're looking at an echidna here. There's a couple echidna species, and there's the duck-billed platypus, which is a truly strange-looking mammal. It has a bill that looks like a duck bill. It lays hard-shelled eggs, but it's a monotreme. Okay. So that's the basal taxon. If you were drawing a tree of all mammals, the monotremes would be here. And then the other branch of mammals would branch again, right? And one of those branches is marsupials. The marsupials are kind of intermediate in terms of primitiveness. More advanced than the monotremes, but not as advanced as the eutherians. Specifically with respect to development of offspring. Monotremes are totally foreign to us in terms of offspring, right? Because they don't bear live young. Their embryos develop in hard-shelled eggs that are laid. In the rest of mammals, including the marsupials, the young develop in the mother. But it's quite different in marsupials compared to how it happens in placental mammals, or eutherians as they're called. What happens in a marsupial is that the pregnant mother, very early on in the development of the marsupial to be, gives birth to it, comes out of the uterus, just like it does in us, only very, very premature. So premature that it looks just like a glob of snot, pretty much. Or just pinkish material. You can't even tell that there's a head or anything. It's just a glob. It's that primitive, like a kangaroo, for instance. Comes out of the vagina, and even though it's hardly anything in terms of body form, it's still almost kind of like an amoeba, only many cells big, kind of walks along the fur outside of the mother's body, and somehow finds the opening to the marsupium, which is the pouch that they're named for. It enters the marsupium, and then inside that, which is outside of the mother's body still, but it's inside the pocket, it finds a nipple and latches onto a nipple and then does the rest of its development, which it would be like the development through the late embryonic and fetal stage in humans. And then only after it gets all through that does it finally then come out of the marsupium, when it really starts living its own life. But that's long after it's born. The birth is when it comes out of the vagina. Further development is really outside of the body, even though it's still carried around by that parent. And then you already know how things happen in eutherians, which are also called the placental mammals. The development occurs entirely within the uterus until birth. Now, that doesn't mean, it depends on the species. Some mammals will give birth to the young and say, see you later. They're ready to go on as is. Those are called precocial animals. Precocial means well developed for their age. The opposite of that is altricial. And we're examples of altricial mammals because even though we are born and we're technically free living, we are our own individual, apart, not attached to the mother, That doesn't mean you can just abandon them and they're going to do well, right? We spend another 18 to 25 years supporting them before they're finally separated. But that's what altricial means. You know, when you see certain birds that just hatch, that don't even look anything like the adult version yet, those are altricial species. They still need a lot of parental care. Okay. So now we can get, well, more specifically than mammals, we are eutherian mammals. And now, more specific than that, we are apes. Well, no, even I skip a step. Even more specific than that, even more specific than saying we're eutherian mammals, is that we are primates. Primates are a kind of eutherian mammal that have forward-facing eyes for good stereoscopic vision. And they have prehensile tails and very well manipulable fingers and toes, or hands and feet, I should say. And so a subset of primates, because there's all kinds of primates that are not like us, are the apes. And the apes, as you see, include things like gibbons and orangutans and gorillas, but also chimpanzees and humans. And it always cracks me up that humans are the only animals that have to be shown with clothes on. That's not a natural condition. These other ones are naked. They don't care. But anyway, all of these ones except the New World monkeys are apes. So we are just one kind of ape. When it comes to comparing us as apes to other apes, though, phylogenetically, we are most closely related to the chimpanzees, more closely related compared to gorillas, for instance. And, you know, we've talked about this a little bit before when we were talking about heterochrony, right? I said that the DNA of a chimpanzee is almost exactly the DNA of a human. That's not what accounts for the differences between the two, right? It's how that DNA is used that's different. But genetically speaking, we are almost duplicates of each other. So we made it all the way to the species. Just have, I think, 4 slides left, and these are typical chapter-ending slides having to do with ecological importances of these groups. In 25, what we're looking at is kind of a before and an after picture, before animals and after animals. Not strictly speaking before animals, because 600 million years ago there already were animals, but it's early in animal history. Before the major familiar animals of today got established, the oceans were much less transparent. They were murky, poorly mixed, low oxygen, dominated by cyanobacteria. And that's because things were growing out of control and there just weren't all that many things eating them. And then when animals came on as successful eating machines, that cleared the oceans up. So this is 70 million years later. This is basically the time when plants and fungi got started on land, right? And then shortly after when animals came onto land. But anyway, in the ocean, it's now well mixed because things are moving around more. It's clear because a lot of these producers, these unicellular producers, are getting eaten by these animals. And the main photosynthesizers have become eukaryotic algae. Rather, there are still cyanobacteria today, but eukaryotic algae are major producers in the ocean. 26, another ecological slide. This one is really a good example of coevolution. Now remember that we talked about how closely the evolutionary trajectories how linked the trajectories of plants and fungi are, which is why we put them in the same chapter, right? They co-evolved on land because they appeared at the same time. Well, here's co-evolution between an animal and a plant. Specifically, a flowering plant. Remember, those are the angiosperms, the most successful plants. But it's angiosperms in particular among plants that have a close relationship evolutionarily with animals, because only the flowering plants have flowers, right? Which attract animals as pollinators. Well, this is a flower that Darwin himself actually found, this species with this really long tail-like appendage on the flower. He found that and said, this really long tube is not an accident. He said there must somewhere be some sort of animal that is able to get in there and get the nectar. And he didn't discover the animal, but we did eventually. This moth has a ridiculously long nose-like proboscis that it can stick all the way up this tube and lick the nectar from that. Whereas, because if you just go in the rest of the flower, it's blocked off from the nectar. So it might attract other insects, but it's just a dead end for them. The only one that can actually get to the nectar is the one that has this long nose. And so this is co-evolution, because this didn't happen overnight, right? The flower got a little longer, and then the insect got a little longer, and they evolved together so that now they rely on each other, basically. It's just an interesting example, but it's involving animals, so it's in this chapter. And then finally we end with a couple bad news slides, as often we do. This one has to do with fish. Age at maturity, that means age at sexual maturity, when they're able to reproduce on their own, is plotted against year here. And it's not a perfect line, but you can clearly see that there's a downward trend if you were to draw a line through this, which means that the age at sexual maturity is getting younger and younger. The reason this is happening is because of human-caused overfishing. It's one of the many problems we're causing ecologically. We're taking too many fish. Now, the ones we want are not the young ones, right? Those are not the ones that are worth money. We take the ones that are older. But that leaves only the young ones, and so we are creating more and more pressure for them to be successful, to develop into sexual maturity younger. Now, they do that randomly, right? Some will do it later, some will do it earlier, but we're putting the pressure that favors the earlier ones. And the reason this is bad news is because obviously this can't continue forever, right? You can't extend this down to zero. It doesn't make any sense to say, okay, the fish have to be sexually mature at zero. That just means they're going to go extinct, which is the bad news aspect of it. And then extinction is also a major problem for actually all animals, all major groups of animals, or at least almost all major groups of animals, are in danger. It's part of this fifth mass extinction that we're at the beginning of, and the one that's human-caused that we talked about. I'm sure you're familiar with examples of plenty of endangered animals, but we tend to care more, or the ones that hit the news tend to be mammals, which, you know, have their own problems, or birds, things that are familiar to our experience. What we don't hear a lot of news about, though, are mollusks. Snails and slugs and things like that are mollusks. Those, as you see in the pie chart, are the group of animals that are actually most endangered compared to birds and insects and others. The picture on the right is just one of the reasons. It's not only because we take too much, which is one problem, like it was for the fish. That remains a problem with mollusks. This is an old picture, 1919, so 100 years ago. They're sitting on a mountain of shells, though, because they killed all these mollusks to make buttons. That's not so much the problem today. Overfishing is still a problem, but now it's mostly the problems in the various forms, including mollusks, is that there's global change. Global change, including global warming, is really the main cause. For various reasons, that's not really the focus of this chapter, but mollusks are particularly in trouble animal-wise. All right.